With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thanks to the brilliant Chris and Kira, back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. It's Tuesday, the 6th of April.
You know what, Donegal? I think they just don't like being our warm-up act. That was it.
We love them too. We definitely do.
That's exactly what it is, Marie. That's all it is.
I wasn't listening.
Well, you can come back tomorrow and warm up for us again. We don't mind at all. Coming up on Game On tonight, we talk Champions League with Mark Langdon as Liverpool prepared to face Real Madrid and Man City host Borussia Dortmund.
To a true footballer, isn't he, Alexander-Arnold? 20 years of age. He's been here since he was 6. And he's spotted that!
Jockey Tom Scudamore rode in his first Grand National at the age of 19, but it's taken him 19 years to get a good ride in the race, and he's going to join us on the phone a little later.
And Gary Murphy and Greg Allen look ahead with bated breath to this year's US Masters.
20 under by Stenson at the opening 16, 20 under by Jason. The 2020 Masters. The long-awaited Masters has a long-awaited champion in Dustin Johnson.
If you want to get in touch, please do so. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
What happened to that other number you were reading out last night when I was listening to you?
Yeah, the one for the north.
Yeah, I think it was on 538 something.
I think it was.
I was thinking that was a new line I'd have to learn.
No, it's not. We'd Rory Best on for the night, and we thought we might get a few people around his way. But to be honest, it was only his mom that was listening, so we might as well have given her my mobile.
Yeah, exactly. It probably has it anyway.
He's with the slags. Marie, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm great.
You have been the busiest person in RT Sport at the moment. I listened to your brilliant podcast, We Become Heroes, where you interview Sonia O'Sullivan. It's fantastic.
Thanks very much. Yeah, so we have a new podcast out. I'm very excited about it. If only I knew a few sporting legends that might come on. Anyone knocking around?
I have a number for Ruby Walsh if you need it.
did I not do one last week? Like, I don't know what you're asking me to do. Do a second one, do you?
Well, you're further down. Yeah, you're actually bumped way down the track.
Yeah, I got bumped off the page by the sounds of it. She's obviously done it because she wants bigger names. She wants you to do one now as well.
She started at the top. You got the pinnacle. Sonia, first off.
Yeah, I think definitely speaking probably for a lot of young women out there who are growing up, and men as well, Sonia was an absolute hero. She was on the international stage and she was so visible when so little women's sport were visible. There was maybe the Camogie finals and the ladies football finals at the end of the year. There was no soccer on the telly. There was no hockey. There was no gymnastics. It was Sonia and the gas. So it was just brilliant to have her when I was younger, I have to say. And it was brilliant to have her on the podcast as well. She was so open. She was great. And I have to also, Donica, give a little bit of a nod to Darren Garrahy, because it was when I was listening to Darren Garrahy's podcast that I got the idea for We Become Heroes, because she does a great thing where she asks everybody the same type of questions. So I do the same with We Become Heroes, and we just kind of track the different sports person's career through asking these set questions, and then it's actually just really interesting to hear the different people answering them and the answers that they gave. And a lot of the time, actually, when I ask about kind of most memorable moments, which was quite interesting, it's the times that they don't succeed. It's the times that they don't win the big match or the final or the big race, and just seeing that competitiveness always coming through, and knowing that it's the losses nearly that seem to play more in the mind than the successes.
Yeah, a big thing for me from listening to it was the loneliness for Sonia. Just the amount of times she had to be so self-confident, how she had to motivate herself. And you think in these, you know, with these athletes and superstars that you see around the place, they're super men and women, and they don't ever flinch. And hearing her saying how vulnerable she was and how low she got was incredible.
And it was after the Atlanta Olympics that it was really, really tough time for her. And I was asking her about that, just how she built herself back up again. Let's have a listen, actually.
The obstacles and challenges that I faced, you know, they were difficulties, but they were never insurmountable. Like, I just had to work it out. I think the hardest part for me was that a lot of the time I had to work it out myself. And, you know, I spent a lot of time by myself in London, particularly in like around 96 and, you know, coming out of that in Atlanta. And yeah, I never really got to talk to anybody properly about, you know, how to manage, you know, such a huge loss and then to come out of that and to build yourself back up again. And it was really just, you know, me wanting to, you know, be better again myself. And I think maybe it went back to my one of my first coaches in Cove, Sean Kennedy. I know, you know, when I would have got injured when I was 17 year old, I can always remember him, you know, walking around the field with me, and he'd say, you know, he said, a great athlete will always come back. You know, you just have to give it time and you have to build yourself up again slowly. And, you know, I suppose if it was more modern times, then I would have been probably able to pick up the phone to him or send him an email or have that communication and say, remember when you said this, you know, how can I, you know, apply that to where I am now? And maybe I did that in my own head, but there's no doubt it took probably a lot longer than it should have. Because, you know, we all know now that when you have issues and problems and, you know, setbacks, that, you know, the more you can talk about it and share it with people, then, you know, the easier it is to deal with it and to push on.
Can you relate to that, Ruby?
Oh, yeah. Without doubt I can. And, you know, I find it, look, I can listen to Sonia all day, like most people, I think, but it's the disappointment of losing. And I know she's saying, like, you've to talk to people, but to actually to talk, it's not that easy when you're dealing with defeat, to actually admit it to yourself what went wrong and then talk about it. And you spend hours processing it in your own mind and figuring it out, and you're almost trying to right a wrong. And I think that's what spurs you to go again. It's to get rid of that horrible sinking feeling of defeat, and you just go again to try and get rid of it and try and win. And yeah, I can relate exactly to what she's saying. Can you, Dunners?
Absolutely. Marie, the big thing for me with it, when I listened to it, I was hoping I'd get nuggets from Sonia about being great. But what I took away from it, I know you're going to laugh at it, but as a kind of coach, underage coach, or someone young, realising the importance of a coach to kind of catch an athlete. And that's what I took from it. Like she mentioned Sean Kennedy there, her first coach, but him being able to identify that she needed help. And I think sometimes I always look for the nugget from, like, the world's best with Sonia, where you realise she's actually given the direction somewhere else with someone that's really important. And just to the importance underage coaches have in making people love the sport. I really took that from it. I thought it was brilliant that she can still remember that, walking around a field, and the importance and the impact it had on one of our greatest. And I think sometimes we overlook it as kind of underage coaches, the importance your role is. So it's a brilliant podcast, fair play to you, but I'd recommend it to anyone that's involved with younger athletes in sport, how important your role is and how it's really going to affect them.
And also, she talks when she is mentioning Atlanta, just how other people helped her, just getting letters, getting advice. Tom O'Riordan, the journalist from the Irish Times, she mentions that he sent her a letter and he was kind of giving her tips and advice on maybe new things she might be trying to pick herself back up again. But she kept the letter and it really meant a lot to her, which is quite interesting as well. But she said so many people reached out to her when she was going through that tough time. And it's not probably something that we do as much now, like write letters. But she said the fact that somebody put a pen to paper and just really wanted to reach out, that helped her recover.
Yeah. I get that. I do get that. Someone goes to the effort of sitting down, getting your address, writing the letter and putting their own name on it. You know, I can understand, even if it's someone you mightn't think might have had something advice to give you, the fact that they have plucked up the courage to sit down and write it and send it to you means they're thinking about you. So yeah, that it is an art that's gone. Sending a text, it's easy to sit down and write a letter. That means something.
Do you know the ones for me? I always appreciated the text messages after a loss. It was so easy to say well done after, you know, a good win or something like that. But you really held value on the ones when you were hurting and someone spotted it.
And it's funny, I appreciated a phone call. I think a text message is easy. Someone pick up the phone and have a conversation with you is hard as well. So I appreciated the phone call.
Yeah. So Donners, if I send you a text, you'll come on, yeah.
I remember we were after some game, we just got stuffed, and I remember Paul O'Connell got a text message saying, Extravision was all to go. A few good men is 2 weeks overdue. Please return a Extravision as soon as possible. That was the only message the whole squad had got. He hadn't known it was. And I remember Phil Vickery on a Lions tour, he had a really poor game in the first test, and he said he opened his text message, and it was one from his mum saying, I still love you.
Very good. So lots of good advice, and they'll be out every week over the next few weeks. So hopefully
well done. It's brilliant. It's a must listen to. It really is, and I highly recommend, especially for people involved with, you know, kids in sport. I think there is absolute nuggets there. Well done, Marie.
Thanks very much. Okay, now let's move on to football, because there is a very busy Champions League night tonight and tomorrow as well. So tonight we have Liverpool, Real Madrid, Man City, Dortmund, and then tomorrow Bayern Munich, PSG, and Porto and Chelsea. So to look ahead to all of the games and also to round up all the European football news, we are joined by Racing Post football editor Mark Langdon. Mark, we're going to start with Liverpool, Real Madrid, because that's the biggest game of the night, in my opinion. So Ramos is out injured and Varane has tested positive for COVID. So it's looking good for Liverpool?
It's looking better than it was on sort of Saturday, when it looked like that Ramos and Varane would be the two centre-backs for Real Madrid. And then just on the eve of that game that Real Madrid played at the weekend, Ramos reported back from international duty with another injury, suffered a lot with them, and then the Varane news only broke today. So, you know, this is not a game really where Liverpool can sort of blame their lack of centre-backs, because Real Madrid are in exactly the same position. What I would say is that I think that Liverpool's front three looks sort of better suited, I think, to exploiting those absences than the Real Madrid one, because Real Madrid, outside of Karim Benzema, have done very little in an attacking sense so far this season.
No, they haven't, Mark, but they've defended quite well in the La Liga. They've only conceded 23 goals in 29 games, so that Liverpool attack will have to be on form.
They will. Obviously, a lot of them games with Varane and Ramos at the heart of that defence. Ramos has not been as regular as what Zidane would have liked, but you know, often they've had at least one of those two available. I think Courtois, the former Chelsea goalkeeper, has had an outstanding season. And when Courtois and Hazard went to Real Madrid, most people would have assumed that, you know, Hazard would have been the bigger loss. In fact, Hazard barely played for Real Madrid, and Courtois has been brilliant more often than not. And I think he's a big reason behind those clean sheets. Looking at what Real Madrid could do tonight, Nacho and Militao look sort of certain to play as two of the centre-backs. It's just whether Zidane wants the insurance of another defender in there. He could move Mendy, the left-back, to make it free at the back and bring in Marcelo as a left wing back if he's feeling a little bit nervous about what Liverpool can offer. He could just, like I say, play with that back four and then bring in another forward. I suspect that Jurgen Klopp will see this as a good opportunity to get at least one away goal. And I think we've, you know, seen enough times in the Champions League over the years, you really do need to try it, you know, to get the away goal. Gone are the days when you play for a 0-0 draw away. You have to play on the front foot, and I'm sure that Liverpool will do exactly that.
Who do you think he will start up front, or maybe he will have extra players up front? He might stick with the usual front three, bring in Jota and just go for it.
Yeah, I mean, he did. I never expected him to do that against Manchester City when he played all four, so I suppose you couldn't rule it out. I mean, I would have thought that Mane, Jota and Salah will be free of those, and then it's a case of whether Firmino plays instead of one of the midfielders. I don't think you need to push it too much. I think the chances will come. And so if it was me, and Jurgen Klopp obviously knows his team much better than what I do, if it was me, I would play with the, you know, Thiago, Fabinho and Wijnaldum as that midfield three, and then play Jota, Salah and Mane as the front three. I think you can't sort of put Jota on the bench any longer. He has to start, and I suspect that Mane and Salah have to as well. So it's just a case of probably Wijnaldum or Firmino is probably the biggest team selection choice, I think, available to Jurgen Klopp. I'd play it a bit safer, and like I said, I think the chances can just come organically without pushing it.
Liverpool have won 6 of their last 7 away matches. Their most impressive performance in 2021 was at the weekend when they beat Arsenal 3-0, and this draw has opened up for them. They're on the right side of it. Could Jurgen Klopp get out of jail this season with the Champions League?
Ruby.
It could. I mean, the Champions League is a funny old competition. Very rarely do the two best teams in Europe compete in the final, and it so happens regularly that teams that you wouldn't have fought it at the quarterfinal stage in that last 16 stage just find a way to reach the final. The year that Chelsea won it, it was absolute chaos under Di Matteo, and yet they somehow went all the way to the final and won it. Tottenham had a really bad second half of the season under Pochettino, reached the final. It's just not uncommon for this to happen, and absolutely spot on, Ruby. They're on the right side of that draw. Anything that is away from Manchester City and Bayern Munich is definitely the place to be on that draw. Whoever comes through will feel like they've got a good shot of beating Porto, or more likely Chelsea, I would say, in the semi-finals. Exactly the same for Chelsea and Porto, of course. They'll also be sort of licking their lips at the prospect of tackling a weakened Real Madrid or Liverpool in the semi-finals. But absolutely, the right place of the draw is to be in this little section of it.
Man City are firm favourites for very good reason, winning 26 out of their last 27 matches in all competitions. But Borussia Dortmund are an interesting one. They're not coming in with much form. But I think when you have a player like Haaland, who is absolutely sensational, and also the type of person and player who has no problem going out and proving a point on the biggest stage.
Yeah, he's definitely got the sort of personality slash arrogance slash confidence that I think you need to be able to play at this level, and he's definitely got that. And Man City have had their demons in this competition before, and when they've gone out, quite often it's been really sloppy starts. If you think back to the game against Monaco, they conceded 3 goals at the Etihad. Against Tottenham, when they went out, they conceded 2 goals in the first 10 minutes. Against Liverpool, that one was at Anfield, but they were 3-0 down inside half an hour. City, for some bizarre reason, have sort of got it in them to just throw in a complete stinker at the Champions League quarter-final stage, and they went out to Lyon last season. Haaland is the type of striker that can take a game away from you. He scored twice against Bayern Munich inside the opening 15 minutes in a game recently for Borussia Dortmund. Point though is that Dortmund still lost that game by 4-2 because defensively they've been an absolute shambles, and that doesn't bode well, does it, when you're about to take on Manchester City. And they're now 7 points off a Champions League spot in the Bundesliga. If they don't make the Champions League, makes it more likely that they'll have to sell Haaland in the summer, not only for the financial reasons, but he's going to want to play at Champions League sort of level, and you couldn't blame him for sort of wanting to be in Europe's premier club competition. So yes, Haaland is a threat to Manchester City, but defensively they've got experience at the back as well. Hummels has won a World Cup. Emre Can has played all over the back for Borussia Dortmund, right back. He's played left back for the German national team as part of a back three and back two as a centre back. Whatever they've done hasn't really worked, and they're just conceding far too many goals, I think, to cause an upset in this game.
Haaland has scored 10 goals in the Champions League this year, and Manchester City have managed to keep a clean sheet in their last 4 games. Is this almost a trial for him to get Pep to buy him?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly would be a nudge in the right direction. I mean, we know that Raiola, his agent, has been in Spain recently talking to Real Madrid and Barcelona. I'm assuming that's to try to just bump up the price. He didn't use any of the back doors at the airports. He made sure everybody saw him going in and out and what his business was. But I don't think the Spanish teams at the moment, unless they can find some new finance, have got the money to buy Haaland. Manchester City makes sense for a lot of reasons, because one, they can afford him, despite what Pep Guardiola was saying. And two, they probably need a striker with Aguero leaving. He wouldn't be the most sort of natural fit for a Pep Guardiola team. He very rarely sort of plays that big traditional number nine centre forward, and the one time that he did have a striker like that, Ibrahimovic at Barcelona, it didn't work out very well for him, and eventually went back to playing Messi almost as like a false number nine. So in some regards he isn't the perfect striker for Pep Guardiola. In others, he just looks a natural fit. And I don't know about you guys, but when you look at the goals he scores, if you put him in that Manchester City team, I mean, he should be racking up sort of 30, 40 goals a season, no problem. The chances they create, the goals he scores, I mean, I think it would be a good relationship. But like I say, he's not the absolute perfect fit for a Pep Guardiola team.
And then Van Dijk will come back from Liverpool and he'll be well able for him. Mark, speaking of big strikers, Bayern Munich are going to have to go into their game against PSG without Lewandowski, who has been ruled out of both legs with injury. Will they be able to cope without him?
They were able to cope without him when they went to Leipzig for the top of the table clash at the weekend. They won by 1-0. Wasn't a brilliant performance from Bayern, but they did just enough. I would have been more confident had Serge Gnabry been fit, but he's really struggling. Hansi Flick, the coach, said today he doesn't think he'll be able to start Gnabry, which means almost certainly that Choupo-Moting, who of course he used to play for Paris Saint-Germain or was a reserve, but more often than not for Paris Saint-Germain, will have to play up front. I think that does limit Bayern. I'd be less confident now than I was when the draw was made that the Bayern will go through. But I still think with Bayern Munich, you know what levels that they're going to put in. They very rarely sort of, you know, give you a 2 out of 10 or a 3 out of 10 performance. And Paris Saint-Germain, they're capable of brilliant games. They're also capable of chucking in sort of absolute stinkers, as they did at the weekend when they were beaten by Lille, and they're now in a real sort of title race that I don't think anybody saw coming, even a couple of weeks ago, really. So I would expect Bayern Munich to go through, although it's probably closer than it was when the draw was made.
Mark, you mentioned that match against Lille, and Pochettino's getting a bit of criticism for his tactical decisions.
Yeah, and I mean, he mentioned it even before that game, actually, that Paris Saint-Germain's different to Tottenham. There's a different spotlight on you, and you've got to win every game as Paris Saint-Germain manager, and when you don't, the questions are asked. So the fact that they're, you know, not top in France and they're 3 points off that top spot, he will be getting criticism, and I don't think that will come as any surprise to him. He used to play for the club, so that was before they had all the money. It's about trying to find the right balance, really. He's been playing Kylian Mbappe on the left wing and Neymar through the middle. Doesn't seem to be working at the moment. Neymar was sent off, so he's getting really frustrated. He's still capable of some brilliant moments, but they're not often enough for how much they've paid for him. So he needs to get that balance right in the final third. They're brilliant individual players. How often do we say this? The collective, not quite right at the moment for Paris.
You mentioned Mbappe there, Mark, and Jorge Valdano, the former general manager of Real Madrid, is open to using Brazilian winger Junior as part of a deal to get Mbappe from Paris Saint-Germain to Real Madrid.
I'm sure he is. I don't know what Paris Saint-Germain would say about that. In terms of those Brazilian wingers, Rodrigo and Vinicius Junior, both of them have, I think, flattered to deceive, really, since they went to Real Madrid. And this goes back to what I was talking about earlier with Haaland, in that Real Madrid and Barcelona both want to be involved in signing these, you know, top elite forwards, and Mbappe and Haaland are being spoken about as the next two, aren't they, you know, behind Ronaldo and Messi. But they haven't got the money to pay for them, so they're looking to be creative in the market and try to give away players. But you know, if Real Madrid don't want Vinicius, then why would Paris Saint-Germain? And I suspect that they'll do everything they can to keep Mbappe, because he's a golden boy of French football. He's a Paris fan. He's from Paris. It would be a sort of humiliation, I think, for the ownership if they lost Mbappe to one of their big rivals. So I don't think it's as easy as Real Madrid just, you know, offering a couple of players and trying to tempt Mbappe that way.
So the fourth game of the tomorrow, the second game tomorrow, four games in total, trying to figure it out here, is the meeting of Chelsea and Porto. And it's pretty rare to be seeing a team going into a game like this coming back off the back of a big hammering to West Brom.
Yeah, I don't. Nobody predicted Chelsea 2, West Brom 5 on Saturday. A remarkable scoreline, even with Thiago Silva's sort of pretty early red card. Both of the games being played in Seville, which sort of negates home advantage, although you could say what is home advantage anyway at the moment without fans. I think the big disadvantage for Porto and therefore the advantage for Chelsea is that Porto are missing not only their top scorer, Sergio Oliveira, who scored 19 goals this season, but Taremi, who's next best in the goal-scoring charts, he's got 15. He is also suspended. Both of those players picked up one, two yellow cards and one a red card in that victory over Juventus in the last 16. That is a lot to take out of the Porto team. So Chelsea have got so many options. Sometimes that can be a problem. Does Thomas Tuchel know his best team at the moment? You could argue, but I think as a manager, you'd rather have those choices than not be able to select your two really key players. So a good opportunity, I think, this for Chelsea to bounce back from that West Brom shocker and put one foot into the semi-finals. And I think that it's an opportunity they really should be taking.
Mark, thanks a million for taking our call. Hopefully there will be three English clubs in a fortnight's time in the last four of the Champions League.
Thank you.
With Green Firm, naturally good food packed with protein. Game on 2FM.
Well, obviously yesterday Freewheel and Dillon won the Irish Grand National, but life moves on quickly in racing like every other sport, and this weekend is the Grand National, the one run at Aintree. And at the minute, Cloth Cap is the clear 4-1 favourite. 4-1 for an English Grand National is nearly unbelievable. But the man who has the job of steering Cloth Cap has joined us on the phone, and that is Tom Scudamore. Tom, how are you?
Very good, Ruby. How are you? You okay?
Absolutely great. Tom, before we get to Cloth Cap on the weekend, I think we have to mention what happened on Saturday at Newton Abbott, and that was the retirement of Richard Johnson, the second most winning jockey of all time, a stalwart of the English weighing room. I think you'll miss him.
Oh, we'll miss him a hell of a lot. I genuinely don't believe there's been a finer ambassador for jump racing, the way he conducts himself. You know him as well as anybody. You could never wish to meet a nicer chap in it and a harder competitor on the track. And it's a well-worn phrase, but you talk about people with their careers. You can look at Richard Johnson. He can walk away with no regrets. He left absolutely everything out there, and was frankly one of the best I've ever ridden with. He was a tremendous fella, and he deserves a long and happy retirement.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it was his manner and his personality that was just exceptional. I don't think you'll find anybody with a bad word to say about him, and that is so rare in any walk of life. He was, as you said yourself, a true ambassador for the sport. But looking ahead to next weekend, Cloth Cap, Tom, you won the Ladbrokes Trophy on him. He absolutely bolted in. He's since gone to Kelso. He looks to be so well treated by the handicapper. How excited are you?
You're very excited. You want to be riding the best horses in any race, never mind just the big ones. He's been a great ride to pick up all season. The Ladbrokes was a great thrill, and winning last time at Kelso too. As you say, he's £14 well in. He's run over 4 miles before. He's trained by a man that knows all about winning Grand Nationals and John Joe O'Neill, and he's owned by a fella that knows all about winning Grand Nationals and Trevor Hemmings. And I'm hoping come Saturday evening, I'll know what that feeling's like.
Is that where you want to be as a jockey, on the favourite in the big race, or do you prefer being on the underdog, Tom?
You want to be on the favourite in whatever race. It's as simple as that. You want to be on the best horses. It's a very privileged position to be in, and you've got to work very hard to get into those positions. But I like to think it's a case of, the harder you work, the luckier you get, and these are the positions that you want to be in. When you dream of being a jockey as a young child, these are the horses and these are the rides you want to be picking up.
Tom, you've ridden in 17 Grand Nationals. View Leon Rouge was your closest finish when you finished 7th. Is it a race you look at and think, "Oof, it's the Grand National again," or do you go out every time still as excited as you did the first time?
I don't know if you can tell it in my voice. There's still the 10-year-old boy in me that's trying very hard not to get out. You know, at the beginning of any season, you want to be riding the big races. At the beginning of any season, you set yourselves little targets, and you know, one of those to get a ride in the Grand National. So to be on the favourite is great. And yeah, every single year you hope that you can be competing in all the big races. You know, just because you know, the last 17 haven't quite gone to plan, I'm hoping that we can put it right this week. I just see it as I'm just a step closer to winning it, but that's my outlook on life.
Why not? You have to look at it somewhere. But Tom, the National, it's always been part of your family, of your history. I mean, your grandfather Michael won it on Oxo in 1959. Your dad tried and tried, never quite won it as a jockey, but he was involved with Earth Summit with Nigel Twist and Davis. He was involved obviously with his partner Lucinda Russell and won for Arthur. Your family is connected to this race.
Yeah, it is. And we're very, very lucky. Look, obviously Dad never got to do it as a jockey, but he was involved in three separate Grand National winners, and Granddad got to ride the winner of the National, and it's something we've all carried through. You know, my children are extremely proud that their great grandfather won the Grand National. It's just part of all our heritage, and it's something we're extremely proud of. And it's just wonderful. You know, it's wonderful to be associated with horses that have gone and competed in the Grand National. Never mind family winners, family members that have gone and become winners. So it's wonderful.
Is it pressure, Tom, or is it just nice to just be associated with something that is so full of history and tradition and nice memories?
It's not any pressure. It's an absolute privilege. You know, I'm very proud of what all my family have gone and done and achieved, but you know, I'm doing it in my way. I've never seen it as a burden. I mean, Ruby will probably tell you better than me. Maybe when I was younger, I felt I probably had a point to prove. But now I'm very happy in myself. I absolutely love the life I lead, and the best word to use is it's a privilege. And unfortunately, as you get older, you realize it's even more of a privilege, because each passing year, you have to look at what Richard Johnson recently, you're getting closer to the back nine. But it's an absolute privilege, and I'm loving every single second of it.
And for you, Ruby, like, you won it, you were quite young, were you early 20s maybe when you won it first?
I was 20, yeah, Papillon. Got lucky on my first attempt, but I got to ride a horse of Papillon's calibre. But Tom, it was a much different race then. When I won it on Papillon, you rode, had your first ride in Northern Starlight in 2001, the year Red Marauder won, and only four horses finished. It was a much different race then compared to now. And has your approach to riding in it changed with how the fences have changed, how the race has changed?
It is a different race to ride in, that you'd know better than anybody else. But before the race, or the cause of the fences, and it wasn't the cause of the fences so much that gave me the biggest problems. I always found it was the drops, and since those have been eradicated, I suppose it's a silly thing to say, because the race is, it's gone from being over 4.5 miles, it's dropped back to 4.25. But since the modifications have been made, I found it's become, even more of a relentless race. The pace doesn't really drop, whereas before, I used to find it was a mad dash to sort of the canal turn, and then you'd sort of find your position and work your way to the chair. Whereas now, it never really seems to. It just seems far more relentless. But look, that's the nature of the race, and the course executive and everybody have done a fantastic job on it, and it's great that it's still the test that it deserves to be.
Oh, it surely is that. I think since they have somehow managed to catch the loose horses, or get the loose horses out of the race, it's made it a more competitive race. But I find that the last time I rode in it, the amount of horses still in the race as you get back to Beechers, Foynavon and the Canal Turn. The Canal Turn is nearly a nightmare now, there's that many horses still in the race.
Yeah, there's still plenty there, and you just hope to be in the right position at the right time. But that's our job to go and do that. It is a different race, but it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's the greatest race there is, and it's a pleasure to be involved with it.
I fully agree with you there, and I wish you the very best of luck on Saturday, although I do hope my dad will shin you with it in a second now.
I understand those torn feelings, but I don't take it personally. It's great to speak to you.
And you, Tom. Thanks a million.
Pleasure.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. A quick and easy addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back, Ruby. It would be really nice fairy tale if Tom Scudamore won the English Grand National. Who stands in his way? Your dad's horse aside.
Yeah, any second now is a chance. Borough Saint for Willie Mullins, a big chance. Acapella Bourgeois is another one. Manila Times, the Mount of Rachel Blackmore will have a big chance too. Oh, there's plenty of horses, Marie. Class Conti, Discorama for Paul Nolan and Brian Cooper. I wouldn't be surprised to see it definitely coming back this side of the Irish Sea. I think there's a strong Irish challenge, even Farclough for Denise Foster and Jack Kennedy will be one with another chance. There's a lot of Irish horses with chances, and we've kind of come to take it for granted that Irish horses will have a chance in the Grand National. But like, I remember growing up as a kid and Irish horses didn't compete in it. Like, when I was born in 79, the first Irish winner I remember at the race was in 99. 20 years, there was no Irish winner. And we take it for granted now that we have so much success there. But look, it is a truly remarkable race, and it's a brilliant race to watch.
A brilliant race to watch, Ruby, but being in it, like, for a jockey, is it completely the moment in front of you? You know, the jumps you were chatting about there, Beecher's Brook, the chair, the water jump, is it, you know, like, how much of it is strategy and how much of it is survival?
Well, it's all survival. You make a plan to go from the start to the first, and then when you land over the first, you make a plan for the second.
Wow.
It's like that. You ride off field, Dunica, and maybe that's why then I struggle watching other sports, and it's all about tactics and plans and moves.
Processes.
I think of yourself, processes. Why can't you just think on your feet? It's there in front of you. And that's what you have to do as a jockey.
Do you have to get psyched up for it? You know, like the weekend.
No, psyched down, I'd say, most of the time.
But like the chair, all these jumps, you know what I mean? They're like, you know that you come down on that, it's going to be, you know, it's going to hurt.
Last year I rode in it, Gillian brought the girls over, Gemma, Isabel and Elsa, and we walked out on the track and we were standing at the chair and the girls were standing in the ditch, the drain in front of it, and it's really quite big, and Isabel was talking about it and Gemma was kind of, you know, maybe whatever, and Elsa looked at me and she said, do you really think Rad Finden can jump this? And I was kind of thinking, well, I kind of hope he can. I don't know if he can or not. I'm hoping he will. But you know, she thought it was quite big anyway.
Ruby, you mentioned Rachel there, and we spoke a bit to you yesterday, but we didn't have time to get into the champion jockey chase that's on at the moment. And it looks like Paul Townend could be out injured for a while with that foot injury that he picked up. Will Rachel be able to chase him down, do you think?
Well, I'd say whatever you look at it, it's probably going to be closer to punch time before Paul gets back. If he does get back, there's only 12 meetings left. There's 12 meetings, about 68 races that Rachel can ride in. If she got a ride in each of those races, it's more realistic that she'd ride in at a max 60 of those. She's operating at a sort of 16% strike rate at the minute. She's 10 behind. It's going to be tight and it'll be very hard for her. You think, oh, he's out, I'll catch up, but there mightn't just be enough races left for her, Marie.
Right, we'll be keeping an eye on that. Very quickly, before we move on to the golf, Liverpool team news is in.
Oh, here she goes. Delighted.
Alisson, Alexander-Arnold, Phillips, Kabak, Robertson, Fabinho, Wijnaldum, Keita, Mane, Salah and Jota. So he's going with a front three, and Firmino is on the bench.
Are you happy with it, Marie?
Ah, yeah, sure, look. The big players in Real Madrid are out missing and Liverpool have a good front three there, so looks like it's
good. She's happy with Klopp.
Yeah. I'm actually just looking forward to going home watching it. It's on RTÉ2 television as well. I meant to say that earlier. Okay, let's move on to the golf. Gary Murphy is standing by, and also Greg Allen. And what is going to be a very busy week of sport already. And then we throw in the Masters on top of everything else, and it is going to be absolutely fantastic, Gary Murphy.
It is. It's all about the Masters, Marie. That's the most important sporting event this week, especially for us golf fans. But It's shaping up beautifully. There's so many good players, top players in the world rankings, all in good form. And I really can't wait for it to start on Thursday. It's an iconic venue, so much history. And it's just, I would say without fail, it always delivers some drama, and I don't think this weekend will be any different.
Hopefully, anyway, that will be the case. Greg Allen is also with us. Greg, I heard you on a podcast earlier on, the three off the tee, and you were talking to Olivia Mahaffey, who has just played the course over the weekend. How did she say it's playing?
It's playing firm and hard and bouncy, just the way they want it to be. And that's really the way Augusta is designed, is what they've put all their sub-air technology beneath the surface of the ground to suck all the moisture out of the ground. They've done that because they want the golf course to play hard and fast and firm. And it didn't last November, and it turned out to be, you know, quite a scoring fest with 20 under par winning. By the looks of things, there is the possibility of thunderstorms on Thursday and Friday. Now, when they call thunderstorms in America, it's not quite what we expect over here. It often just means very heavy rain. And last November, they had 3 hours of what they called a thunderstorm just before, really, just in the first round. And it changed the way the entire tournament was viewed in terms of the players, because the ground was already quite moist, and it made it much more moist, and it didn't dry out for the week, and so it was a bomber's paradise. But when the golf course plays as hard and firm and fast as Olivia was saying it is, that means that it brings a whole load of other players into the equation. Mid-range hitters, even short-range hitters can find that they can negotiate the ball around. And, you know, okay, the course was much shorter in 99 when I covered my first Masters, and Jose Maria Olazabal won it. But he negotiated the ball around Augusta, and before that, Ben Crenshaw. This is going back in time a bit, but it is still possible for somebody like Zach Johnson, who kind of negotiates the ball around a golf course, to do so if it plays hard and fast and firm. And I think it brings a whole lot more players into the equation of who could be champion with the green jacket around their shoulders on Sunday.
Gary, since Greg covered his first Masters in 99, there's been over 500 yards added to the course. And I mean, the last short hitter to win it was Zach Johnson in 2007. Is it possible for a short range hitter still to win the Masters?
I'd be surprised, because at the very top level, they're so good. The 500 yards doesn't really matter, because equipment and the golf ball have changed so dramatically in that time. So You know, it's probably still playing similar to what it did then, because they're in the ball so much further now. But I'd be astonished if a plotter won around here this weekend. There's so much heavy artillery at the top. I guess Morikawa would be the kind of shortest hitter of the stars, and he's already won a major last year. He won a WGC a couple of weeks ago. The big thing with him is his iron play. Augusta National is really about placement of your second shots and trying to get on the right side of the pin, which is the hardest thing to do when you're under so much pressure. That'll be his strong suit, and that's why he'll have an outside chance. But I'd be astonished if a short hitter won this week.
And Greg, what about age? Because 7 of the last 11 winners have been 35 and under. Do you think it is there for a young man to win?
Well, you see, 35, how old is 35 in golf terms? It's old if you're a footballer, but in golf terms, it's...
Or a jockey.
Exactly. You know, 35-year-old jockeys keep going, don't they, Ruby?
Just about.
Yeah, maybe sometimes beyond where they should go, but because you don't bounce like you used to. But one of the things about golf is, in the last 10 years, maybe 5 years even more so, it's become, you know, a very athletic game, and players have realised that if you go to the gym, you gain a great deal. You gain stability, you gain injury prevention, so long as you don't use the gym to get injured in, which some do. But in general, the age of a player is coming down, I think. You know, if you look at the world's top 10, Dustin Johnson, I think, is 36, but Justin Thomas, John Rahm are in their 20s, Colin Morikawa in his 20s, Bryson DeChambeau, Xander Schauffele. You know, most of them are these days either in their 20s or early 30s. It's a young man's game. There are very few players over the age of 35 who are really winning these days, apart from Dustin Johnson. But then again, Dustin Johnson is a physical specimen. He may be one of the greatest athletic players to ever play the game of golf. He is just such an athlete. So I think he's an exception and an outlier to that. But in general, 35 or under, it's where it's at these days.
Gary, Dustin Johnson's going to walk into Augusta this week as the reigning champion, but I know he's the world number one, but he's been a little hit and miss this season, and frankly, it looks a bit out of form.
He does, yeah. There's no denying that. He won in Saudi early in February, and then went back to play in the PGA Tour, and he's done absolutely nothing. He hasn't contended at all. I think he had a chance at the Genesis and faded poorly at the weekend.
And then he had this, will I play last week, will I, won't I play, which, you know, maybe he was going to play and look for something and decided to stay at home and try to figure it out on the range. So he's certainly not as primed as he was in November. I think after the FedEx, you know, he was by far and away the best player in the world. There was a lot of hype about DeChambeau, but Johnson was at the top of his game going in there, and he's not at the top of his game coming in this week. But he does have that emotion of defending champion that will help him. He's going to be a danger because he's so good tee to green. And he's got that belief now. He's got two majors. So he should be a threat, but he's certainly not. Like in November, I just thought it was pretty much a penalty kick for him to win. And that's not the case this time.
Greg, I know two of the things that you look for are somebody who likes Augusta and is coming in with form. Is there somebody that you think has these two things heading into it?
Well, there's a very obvious player, and that's Jordan Spieth, you know. Just one thing as well, because that, you know, analogy about, you know, someone who's a short or mid-range plotter who might not be able to win at Augusta, and we're looking back to Zach Johnson being the last champion of that sort of nature in 2007. It might just be remembered that 2019, Francesco Molinari, who is mid to short in terms of distance on the PGA Tour driving statistics, he was just a wedge shot away, well, a 9-iron by the sound of things on the 12th, and a dumped wedge into the water on 15 away from being the person who should have had the green jacket around his shoulders. You know, Molinari really did show that a mid-range hitter can negotiate the ball around Augusta pretty well. It's all about that second shot to the green, the placement of the ball beneath the pin. And I don't think there's a whole lot of players better than the person I mentioned at the start of this answer, Jordan Spieth. And Spieth has got form, which is, if you look through the world's top 10 since the start of 2021, Jordan Spieth's form compares to every single person in the world's top 10 since the start of this year. So wipe away his position in the world rankings, which I think is 38th or thereabouts, and just consider Jordan Spieth as one of the three or four favourites here because he's got form. We know he loves Augusta. In 2016, when he threw away a five-shot lead in the back nine, that may have been the beginning of the malaise which led to his slump, although he did win the Open in 2017. But look at the way he won the Open in 2017. Although he charged with a bunch of birdies and an eagle in the last five holes, he had that awful scenario on the 13th with that 22-minute delay to get a drop behind tour vans miles off the golf course. And that's what he's prone to. He's prone to being human and not, you know, perfect. But Spieth has form from winning in Texas. He has confidence because before Texas, he had three top four finishes this season. And only really Bryson DeChambeau in the world's top 10 has a 2021 that looks to be, you know, as good as Jordan Spieth. So Jordan Spieth, for me, is that player that you mentioned. You know, I think he is the guy who's in form and loves the place. And I think loving Augusta is a huge part of it.
Gary, what do you think? Do you think there is somebody, aside maybe from Jordan Spieth coming into this, who loves Augusta and is showing form?
My pick for the week is Justin Thomas. He won the Players a couple of weeks back. He started off pretty well, and then he had, you know, obviously the issues around the comments that he made. He lost some sponsorship. He lost a lot of kudos, I think. I think emotionally it got to him a bit. His granddad died, who was unbelievably close to him, part of his early golf career. So he had a lot of issues off the course. And then he came back and he won at the Players. The big thing for me with Thomas is this is his sixth Masters, and he's improved every single time he's played. He's 39th, 22nd, 17th, 12th, and he was 4th in November. He's his last seven rounds, he's broken par around Augusta. He has the belief, he has the trust to win a major. He's shown that when he won at Quail Hollow. And I think he is the winner on Sunday night.
Not so bad. Craig, the Irish interests revolves around Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry. And Rory is coming in here with so many question marks to answer. He's chasing his first Masters. A 79 and a 75 at Sawgrass, 10 over par, meant he missed a cut at the Players. Ian Poulter hammered him 6 and 5 at the match play. I know he's gone to Pete Cowan now, he's a new swing coach. How does he re-find form?
I think the fact that we're talking about Rory McIlroy after about 8 or 9 minutes of this conversation tells us a great deal about what Rory McIlroy and what his standing is in the world of golf. It might be remembered that this time last year he was the world number one, and he was still world number one until around June and early July, and possibly even that late. So that's, you know, not that distant, you know, a piece of time between when he was the player that everybody that was looking at. Now, what's happened, obviously, is that he's lost something very, very, very significant. And it's I think it's been an attrition level of being in position to win a lot of PGA Tour events on Sunday and not getting the job done. It's a part of the attrition as well of starting majors really badly, consistently, since he last, you know, in terms of not every major he started badly, but like he started the 2018 Masters quite well and was in position after a 65 on Saturday and then didn't do it on Sunday. So it's either a bad start or it's a bad Sunday, but there doesn't seem to be four rounds in a row for Rory, whether it's even an ordinary PGA Tour event or a major, since he last won a major in 2014. So he's gone to a new coach. Pete Cowan is, I think Gary's probably more familiar with Pete than I am, but I've been in Pete's company quite a bit over the years, just listening to him, because he's a very wise guy in terms of wise man, not wise guy in a gangster sense. He's dresses all in black, mind you. He's a fantastic person for coaching a player in the holistic sense, more than simply their technical game. Pete Cowan says that your game, the technical part of it, is that's almost the easy part. It's coaching the attitude of a player that he likes to think that he's really good at. He points to a story of Darren Clark arriving on the practice ground in 2011 at Royal St George's for the Open. When Pete was on the practice ground very early, Darren comes on the practice ground looking very haggard and very downbeat, and they've worked together for years. And Darren Clark asks Pete Cowan for one thing that he can do to get him through the week, because he's been playing so badly. He played so badly in the final round of the Scottish Open, and Pete Cowan gave him a move. Darren was practicing the move until about 9 o'clock in the morning, and suddenly it clicks. And from there on, he gave a stripe show on the back on the practice ground, showing Pete what he could do with the golf ball. And he went on to win that week. And Pete Cowan is renowned, he says it himself, in the early part of his career, for being a quick fix coach, someone who can turn somebody around quickly. He's had 2 weeks with Rory. Can he do it with Rory? That, I think, is about the amount that Rory buys into Pete and the amount that Pete coaches the attitude of Rory as much as the game of Rory, and gets Rory thinking like the player that he used to be, because he hasn't been that player since 2019, certainly the end of 2019, when he went on a really good run towards the FedEx Cup win.
Gary, it's very interesting listening to Greg there, because there's no doubt Rory McIlroy has the ability, but can what Greg is describing actually happen?
I think the big issue is trust. I think quick fixes are essentially what happens week in, week out. There's very few players in the history of the sport that, you know, plan to do something long term. Rory McIlroy is the type of player, he could go down the first and Thursday morning and feel something in his swing, and that's it. He could shoot 20 under and win in a canter. The only thing worried me in the match play against Poulter was that he looked like he was making swings, not hitting golf shots, and I don't think I've ever seen him do that. He does that occasionally, or has done that historically, with his wedges, where he makes swings and doesn't hit shots. And I think I'm not sure about the Cowan-McIlroy relationship. I don't personally think it'll bear fruit. I hope it does, because I'm a big fan of McIlroy's, and I'd like to see him win more majors, and I'd love to see him win a Grand Slam on Sunday night. But I'm not quite sure that it's going to work out. Rory just needs to go back to being Rory. You know, be wily and consistent, I don't have a problem with that, but his brilliance has to be the focus of where his game is going. He doesn't have to be consistent, he just has to be that player that can turn up and destroy events. And if he goes down the road of trying to build a new golf swing, I think he could be catastrophic.
I think everybody would just like to see him be the Rory that we all know he can be. What about Shane Lowry, though, Greg? He's been very confident heading into this. He's really happy with how he's playing. He said the biggest challenge for him is to stay out of his own way.
Yeah, Shane, I think, really does feel as though he's about to start playing really well again. And Shane can play well in spurts and obviously be the player who has won a World Golf Championship and a major championship. And this is the thing about Shane. I don't think we're ever going to see a player, in, you know, with Shane's DNA, such an smartest of the game, be consistently a good player, knocking off wins on a very regular basis. I think we're going to see Shane have the occasional dip, but when he actually ascends to the ability that he has, he becomes a world beater. Like, that six-shot win in Royal Port Rush was just something to behold, quite apart from the fact that it was on Irish soil. If it was a major and Shane Lowry was playing in an open championship venue in Britain, and he had done that, I it would have got equal attention, I think, for the pure quality of destroying a field by six shots. The way that he won the World Golf Championship event in 2015, with the shots that he played on the back nine from in the trees on the 10th, and the birdie he made from the trees on 18, the par that he made on 14 when he was out of position. He did things which were just almost Tiger-esque, in the right choices, the right time, and he's feeling good about his game after that 8th place finish in the Players' Championship, and he feels good with the putter in his hand, because everything else about his game seems to be in position to be someone who can better a tied 25th best ever finish in the Masters.
I most certainly hope you can, Greg Allen. Thanks a million. Same to you, Gary Murphy. Donegal, who's up next?
Tara Short's up next. A massive thank you to Andrew and Laura Lee. Myself and Marie are back tomorrow at 6.